Okay, we're back for episode 80 of Powers and Principalities. And I think we are recording on the night of December 7th, 2018. Of course, this is Pearl Harbor Day, Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. That's what my calendar claims. Pearl Harbor. So, Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well. Thanks.
On this day that will live in infamy.
An infamous day, that's for certain. Of course, on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, Japan launched a sneak attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. This shattered the peace on this beautiful, clear morning. It's always on these very clear, sunny mornings. This did considerable damage to the U.S. fleet out there. About 2,400 sailors died, servicemen died. Close to 200 planes were destroyed. Of course, this was the event that catapulted the United States into the Second World War officially, at least against Japan. Of course, Japan had declared war officially moments after the assault, and the United States declared war 4 days later when Franklin Roosevelt went before Congress and delivered his famous speech. The next day, it was 4 days later that Germany actually declared war on the United States, thus officially drawing the United States into the European War as well. So the World War had turned into a truly global conflagration at that moment. So Pearl Harbor, a lot of controversy, of course. There's been a lot of research since then that has been uncovered, or at least has uncovered the fact that there is considerable evidence of foreknowledge by the Roosevelt administration, also acts of provocation. There are various advanced knowledge conspiracy theories regarding Pearl Harbor. Robert Stinnett, U.S. Navy Rear Admiral, Alfred Theobald, made these claims back in the 1940s. Of course, there was the revisionist historian Harry Elmer Barnes. The various officials in the British government claimed that both the British government and the U.S. government knew of the attacks in advance. This was done to encourage the United States into the European war. After the attack, there were a series of inquiries. I think they've been 10 official inquiries into the Pearl Harbor raid. There was the Secretary of Navy Frank Knox had a commission. There's a Roberts Commission, 1941-1942, the Hart Inquiry, 1944, the Army Pearl Harbor Board, 1944, the Naval Court of Inquiry, 1944, the Hewitt Investigation, the Clark Investigation, the Congressional Inquiry, the Pearl Harbor Committee, 1945-1946, and the Top Secret Inquiry by Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson. Of course, then there's also Henry Clausen, which I think you'll have something to say about. The Clausen Inquiry in 1946. They came with different results or different conclusions, or at least, well, from what I understand, is the Army Pearl Harbor Board and the Naval Court of Inquiry were the two official inquiries that got closest to the truth. But then I think this was during the war, so the conclusions were never published under the guise of national security, and didn't want anything to hurt the morale of the war effort. This was during the war. There are several accusations of witnesses having to recant their earlier testimony about evidence they had seen of foreknowledge and cables they had seen or information they had gotten that had suggested that Washington had foreknowledge of the attack. So there's a lot of controversy about Pearl Harbor. We can get into that, I suppose, about Pearl Harbor, why it was allowed to happen, and was it necessary for the United States to get into the war at this point to save the world from Hitler and Tojo and these things. So, Joe, what do you have to say?
Well, I think that we arranged for the Japanese to attack. What degree of control we had over the Japanese military is an open question. But I presume you've seen the McCullen Memorandum that was circulated in 1940. That was basically a blueprint that arranged American foreign policy in such a way that to guarantee the Japanese would attack. So what level of conspiracy was needed between Roosevelt and the Army intelligence to make sure the attack was effective and good enough, you know, for propaganda purposes to set off the war. I mean, you know, it's really, you can't really get at that kind of evidence. It just isn't available. But you can certainly understand that Pearl Harbor was brought about deliberately because, you know, we've done other shows showing that World War II was basically a controlled demolition of the European population. You know, we did a show where we showed how the Nazi Party had been created basically over a 60-year span. Central to that was Helen Blavatsky, and of course the Masonic circles that she ran in, and they created all of the aspects of the Nazi Party, and they obviously did it for the purpose of basically using the German war machine as one half of the mill that they would reduce European population. So the idea that Roosevelt would somehow have been unaware of this is not possible, because for one thing, Roosevelt is simply outed as a very high-level Mason. That's not a conspiracy theory. He was. And so he certainly would have been involved with that. And I wanted to just underline one point about the Freemason creation of World War II. In the show we did on it, you know, I said that Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society had been in, you know, in so many of the areas that led up to the Nazi Party. It's just beyond any possible, random chance. It was clearly deliberate. But there was one thing that I missed and I wanted to mention because it sort of seals the deal on the whole thing. Blavatsky claimed that she had gone to Tibet and had these mystical experiences, which ended up as the occultism, which then, you know, bleeds into the occult structure that leads up to the Nazi Party, you know, with the Theosophical Society in Memphis and Mizraim. But her biographers have doubted this. They couldn't find any evidence of her travels. And in fact, they you know, the historians that I have read say that they think she's lying. Well, she was lying. It turns out that that we really do know where she was during this period. And it's an incredible story because it actually shows why she was the one that was selected to basically organize World War II. Blavatsky was with Garibaldi, the Red Shirts in Italy, and she was at the Battle of Mentana, right? And I didn't know this when we talked about it before, but it's just an incredible fact, because this was when she was supposed to be getting all of this channeling from the, you know, enlightened masters and stuff. And don't worry, Tim, I'm getting to Pearl Harbor. I know it's a little segue here, but we're getting there. But the fact is that she was on Mentana, and this was why they selected her. When she was there, she had been wounded three times, two shots through her body. But more importantly, she had gotten into a saber battle, and she had her arm broken in two by a saber stroke. And this is not, not well documented. The Freemason partner, Olcott, actually described seeing, you know, her left arm where it was broken by the saber stroke, and he could feel the scars where the, you know. So my point is, Garibaldi is the one then who passed along this metaphysical Memphis and Mizraim nonsense to the Quattro Coronati Lodge we've talked about. But he also passed along Blavatsky, because Garibaldi would have seen her as a completely insane mad dog fanatic. You know, I mean, if you're doing, say, if you're like battling, you know, with hand-to-hand combat if you're a woman. So anyway, she was part of what was called Garibaldi's Red Shirts, which then became the Black Shirts, which was the Italian fascism, which then was, you know, organized into the Brown Shirts. So it was a pretty straight trajectory into the Nazi Party from Garibaldi. And we won't go into all that, but it just underlines that the World War II was fake. It was, you know, it was orchestrated, set up. The Blavatsky stories doesn't hold up. You know, this business of the Battle of Mentana, which incidentally, Garibaldi was fighting against the forces of the Roman Catholic Pope. So that's who, you know, that's who that Blavatsky was fighting against when she, you know, took the saber stroke. Anyway, so World War II was fake. It was set up. Now, Roosevelt, I think we know he is a crypto. You know, there's a lot of speculation about this, and there's really not any good evidence. I've looked at that, you know, the Roosevelt family's backgrounds. If they're, you know, the Jewish background is buried beyond anything I can find. But we know he's a crypto, Tim, because remember we've talked about the Burden of Jerusalem. It's a poem. It's online. Everyone can go and look at it. Written by Rudyard Kipling. No one knew about it. It was a secret. And then it was uncovered in one box of Churchill papers that he had had a correspondence with FDR. And he had sent the Burden of Jerusalem to FDR with a note saying, got to keep this secret. We can't show this to anybody. This is just for your eyes. Now, Roosevelt wrote back saying, yeah, I've seen it. He actually had another secret backdoor communication into this, into Kipling's Masonic crazed, vicious poem, which, of course, in and of itself is telling that Roosevelt would have a backdoor like that. But Roosevelt called the poem a gem. He just loved the poem, loved the poem. Poem starts out with that great passage from Genesis where Abraham says to Sarah, you know, behold, thy maid is in your hand. Do to her as it pleases thee. And then Sarah slaps her around and the Gentile runs away. That's how the poem starts out. But then you have it gets terrific because Kipling talks about, you know, that the hatred that that Gentiles will experience from, he says, beneath the rabbi's curls and fur are scents and rings of movie kings, the aloof, unleavened bread of yore, brewed steadfast on Jerusalem, and burdened Gentiles over the main must bear the weight of Israel's hate. That's just a pleasant little, you know, kind of ditty you can read to your kids. And so Roosevelt's response to Churchill about Kipling's just bizarre and, you know, obviously kind of, it makes perfect sense as the hatred of someone who keeps a Jewish identity secret, like what I suspect Kipling did, but it makes no sense at all for any kind of a Gentile to, you know, look at a poem like this in any other way than it's, you know, it's offensive. The poem is available online. I hope everyone goes and looks at it. It's called The Burden of Jerusalem. And in the website, you actually can see the correspondence between Churchill and Roosevelt, where Churchill tells Roosevelt, you've got to keep this secret. And so anyway, that's kind of the, to me, this is the analytic way you can get to understand Roosevelt. Somehow he's working in these Masonic circles, and this is where, you know, you can have an understanding of Pearl Harbor. This is where, you know, when you look at Roosevelt in that light, you can see that, the whole thing is, you know, to what specificity Roosevelt was orchestrating it, you know, to bring it about, to make sure it was going to happen, I can't tell you, but I know he was doing it. I know that he was part of the organization that was creating World War II, and they absolutely had to have America come into the war, basically to hold the German nation frozen on the Western flank so that the population could be in the crushing mill between the Russian forces on one side and the Allies on the other, and just wipe out the German population. So because this was obviously the plan, Roosevelt and Churchill have this communication, which I think is just self-evident what the meaning of it is. Roosevelt would have found a way to get America into the war. And so I think that this just, is the correct way of looking at it, that, with the McCullen memorandum, you can see the steps that were organized to make sure that Japan attacked. I mean, all of the understanding of their codes and everything, supposedly, that that Roosevelt had been aware of. But so the reason that I think that the attack was not a surprise, and in fact had been provoked, is because of Roosevelt's other connections into Freemasonry, his communications with Churchill. This tells me that the guy is in fact dirty as hell, and was part of the process by which this fake world war was established, for the population reduction and political empowerment of this small group.
Yeah, that observation, as far as the provocative nature of U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis Japan in 1941, has been acknowledged. I think it was Oliver Littleton, the British Minister of Production, stated in 1944 that Japan was provoked into attacking America at Pearl Harbor, is a travesty of history to say that America was forced into the war. The McCullen Memorandum even says it's like an 8-point plan, which turns out that most of the points were implemented by the Roosevelt administration. I think the memorandum itself ends with saying that should this lead to war, that would be a desirable outcome. So U.S. diplomacy towards Japan was to provoke a war, for the reasons stated. You stated earlier, it was obviously one reason or another. The Roosevelt administration's objective in 1941 was to get America into the war, and other people have said that, of course, Pearl Harbor or the war in Japan was a backdoor to the war in Europe. It's interesting to also point out that Japan itself, prior to the 1850s. Was sort of an insular isolationist island nation, which was pried open by gunboat diplomacy by the United States, by Commodore Perry, who was the father-in-law to August Belmont, the Rothschild agent in the United States.
So, yeah, and he was a big Freemason, and he brought Freemasonry into Japan. Freemasonry has been in Japan since Perry. When they opened it up, gunboats, one of the things they inserted was Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm. And so that was, for the early part of the 20th century, Japan was sort of the cat's paw of the Anglo-American powers in Asia. And they modernized. Saw what was going happening in China, and so they modernized along Western lines and Western advice. And, of course, we all know about Jacob Schiff, and he helped finance the Russo-Japanese War to get the Japanese to attack the Russians in 1905 to weaken the Romanov dynasty. Up until the late 1920s or 30s, Japan was sort of, again, a cat's paw of Anglo-American policy. Then perhaps they got a little too big for their britches, and they needed to be taken down a peg or two and then brought back into the fold, which is what the war was all about. But if you look at the Pearl Harbor itself, it's been, it wasn't too long after the attack that rumors began to circulate that challenged the official narrative. I think it was Morgenstern, writing for the Chicago Tribune, wrote about this, and showed it, what's his name? Oh, well, Admiral Theobald, of course, and John T. Flynn. Wrote about this. So the alternative media at the time, they were publishing books about this as early as the 1940s. It just wasn't getting out. What was the reasons for the treachery? As we stated, Roosevelt wanted to plunge U.S. into the European war. They were unsuccessful in provoking Germany in the North Atlantic. And so he decided to provoke war with Japan. Of course, Germany, Japan, and Italy were part of the Tripartite Pact. And I guess thought that, you know, a war with Japan would bring Germany to the war. Of course, the United States had been sort of an unofficial war with Germany in the North Atlantic for the better part of a year. So there is, for the longest time, Germany wouldn't be provoked like they were in the First World War. But nevertheless, there are people who defend the act, this action. Even Robert Stinnett, who wrote the book, Day of Deceit, he said that, I sympathize with the agonizing dilemma faced by President Roosevelt. He was forced to find securest means to persuade an isolationist America to join in the fight for freedom. Of course, the standard justification for U.S. entry into the war at that time is, if not for U.S. intervention, Hitler would have defeated Britain and Russia and completed his conquest of Europe. With the resources of the entire European continent at his disposal, Hitler then would have turned his forces against North America to achieve his dream of world domination. I know it sounds silly now, but there, yeah. Of course, there are several problems. First is greatly underestimates the difficulties of a transatlantic invasion.
Yeah.
couldn't even get across the channel. It grossly exaggerates Germany's military abilities, even to at the apex of her power. It also confuses the conditions of December 1941 with those of June 1940. By the time the Pearl Harbor raid, the fortunes of war had already turned against Hitler. The Barbarossa had stalled in Russia. There'd been a counteroffensive, and the German forces were on the defensive. So they had failed to conquer Russia. And what happened was the German army was left to fight a war of attrition in Russia, which wasn't going to turn out well. And really, by the end of 1940, with the Battle of Britain, losing the Battle of Britain, and of course having no real desire to invade Britain, Britain really wasn't threatened with annihilation. They could have come to terms with Hitler, and Hitler offered several times to come to terms. So the argument that U.S. entry was vital, it just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. You could make the case that Lend-Lease played a role in Russia being able to fend off the German onslaught, but the point is direct U.S. military intervention, and therefore the justification for Roosevelt's deceit at Pearl Harbor, his noble lie, if you will, simply doesn't stand up to scrutiny, just on the objective sure. facts.
Yeah, I mean, and that level of understanding is completely adequate to, you know, recognize that, you know, World War II was our introduction into it, and it was all orchestrated by FDR for some reason.
And they were even trying to say that Japan was trying to conquer the world.
And of course, when you look at the McCollum memorandum, yeah. You can see that they really had to go out of their way to try to force the Japanese with very provocative and just impossible to accept conditions where they were going to cut off the Japanese energy. And they were simply mm-hmm. very bold about this, and so the Japanese felt that they had to try something. They were basically backed into a corner. But what they didn't understand is that they were being just deliberately provoked to create this propaganda moment. I mean, World War, I mean, the Pearl Harbor, this is just it's a propaganda stunt.
Yeah, there was a Japanese diplomat who he's being admonished by the Roosevelt administration for Japanese expansionist ambitions in Asia. In Asia, of course. Yeah. So look at the map. He goes, just when we learned to play poker, they changed the game to bridge.
Right.
Really, Japan's crime was being a latecomer into the imperial ball. And so it wasn't like, you know, every country had a sphere of influence. The United States had its Monroe Doctrine. The Coast Prosperity Sphere was sort of like the analog to the Monroe Doctrine. And Japan at the time was really threatening the beleaguered European colonies, which is something that I didn't think the United States was obligated to defend.
Yeah. You know, it's that is correct. And I think kind of the best understanding of the historical process that is available. I think analytically you can, you know, have other conjectures, other sort of plausible ideas. I have like one of my conjecture is that there was Masonic mm-hmm. influence in the Japanese side. If you look at the number of individuals who are known to be Masons who are inside the imperial family. Now, you know, this is after the fact, but I think what I suspect is that it had gone on, you know, since Perry, and they basically had traitors that they could count on to do something as silly as, you know, invade Pearl Harbor. I can't prove that, but I will just say if that's the case, right, then the attack code of Torah, Torah, Torah is a pun.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's not something I can prove. It's just something that amuses me to consider it. But, you know, if you look at today, there's something really sick and weird that Masonry has, you know, after Pearl Harbor and after the war that it's going on in Japan. I mean, they've got, I just won't even read the list, but there's a very long list of people who are in the imperial family who for some reason want to be Masons. And this one guy who briefs the imperial household agency, his name is Tomosu Murayama. He talks about, you know, very publicly on these wonderful fundamental principles of Freemasonry, which are to build character and realize building a better tomorrow. And here's one of my favorite quotes. And this is from the father of Princess Chichi Ibu. He says, who commented, "I know Freemasonry very well. I admire the principle, the fraternity that advocates and practices universal brotherhood. I am sure that Freemasonry alone can save this world from destruction." Right. Now, that is Count Tuseyo Matsudaira. I can't be butchering it. But he's the father of the princess. Now, the thing that's really interesting to me, Tim, is that, I mean, I guess this guy has heard of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, hasn't he? Mm. You'd think so, right? Someone probably mentioned it to him, the atomic bombs. I mean, has anyone ever mentioned that Truman, you know, was a Mason? And how about, you know, the guys who developed the bomb? You know, Teller what's his name? You know, the other guy. They were Masons. And so how in the world... Oppenheimer. And so how in the world can this guy make that statement if he isn't some kind of controlled robot? I mean, that statement is just so shocking that when, you know, you've had cities full of women and children nuclear bombed by basically a straight line of nothing but Masons, how can you make that statement, Tim, unless there is something, you know, that's really, you know, unseen, you know, that's working inside the Japanese society. MacArthur, you know, another Mason, of course, you know, when he took over Japan, he made special considerations to open the door of Freemasonry to Japanese. And they created a lodge right at the point where in the Naval Academy, where the decision to have, you know, gone ahead with the attack on Pearl Harbor was made. That area is now a Masonic temple, which I think is very telling, you see, that they would you know, do that. So I can't prove this, Tim. I just have, you know, this. When you see the secret society in operation on the other side of the world to set up the European, you know, mill to destroy the population, and then you look at all of the levels of Masonic power and individuals and Perry's you know, the first thing he brings into Japan is Freemasonry, basically, as far as anyone can tell. You see, I just smell a rat here, and so I think that you know, when you look at this terrible disaster of, you know, the Pearl Harbor attack, that I think that I would like to see Japanese historians start to look inside their political world and inside their political history for the real answers. Because I think that even with the McCollum memorandum and the structure that Roosevelt put in place, I still think that basically the attack on Pearl Harbor was more suicidal than anything else. And I just wonder, well, what really brought that about? You know, I think the idea of the, you know, the obviously the Japanese being kind of interested in world domination. I mean, this is just, you know, weak propaganda.
Yeah, it's a wartime. I think it was Joseph Grew who narrated. He was the ambassador to Japan.
Yeah.
And he narrated this typical 1940s movie about Japanese ambitions, that how they had dreams of Tokyo being the world capital and this world-girdling empire was just, I mean, come on, it's not, it's, you know, the objectives of the Japanese were pretty limited, overtly. I mean, it was like they wanted to bloody the nose of the United States like they did to the Russians in 1905 and come to some sort of settlement. They weren't going to invade the West Coast and conquer the United States, and it wasn't like Germany was going to invade the East Coast and Japan was going to invade the West Coast, and we get something, a scenario like we get in that TV show, the Man from High Castle or something.
Yeah, yeah.
These fans.
Yeah, it's just, yeah.
Man from High. Yeah. So it's just this complete. I mean, come on, just complete utter nonsense. If anyone just have a working knowledge of geography knows that this is stupid. But if it worked well with the American people, obviously the attack itself destroyed whatever non-interventionist sentiments there were in the United States. And I guess at the time, Americans were very naive, thinking, you know, the government could do this. Although, again, there were people who did voice concern, or at least skepticism about the official narrative, or you're just suppressed. The press then, as today, was controlled. So the American people weren't properly informed of what was really going on.
Well, I mean, I'll give you an example. In one of the investigations, in fact, I think this was perhaps the best known, was conducted by Henry C. Clausen. And, you know, he was the judge advocate for the U.S. Army, and he was a lieutenant colonel, and he was a historian. And he was the one that was selected by the U.S. Secretary of War to conduct, you know, this very high-level investigation into the Pearl Harbor attack. Now, this is pretty funny, Tim, because you know, Clausen was basically investigating, you know, Roosevelt's complicity and perhaps not, you know, warning the people that he knew the attack was coming. Now, this is funny because Stinson, who picked him, picked Henry C. Clausen, who was, in fact, the sovereign grand commander of the Supreme Council Scottish Rite in the southern jurisdiction of the United States. So, I mean, he's not just a Mason, he is the Mason. I mean, this is actually the guy who succeeded Albert Pike.
He is the Albert Pike of his day, okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's literally, he is yeah. Albert Pike's direct successor this is the title, the sovereign grand commander of the Supreme Council. So the idea that he was going to then, you know, investigate FDR is just preposterous because, you know, he was investigating Roosevelt and Marshall, because General Marshall was supposedly, he was in charge of the intelligence gathering. But they're both Masons, Tim, Roosevelt and Marshall. So you've got Clausen the Mason investigating Roosevelt and Marshall. It's just a little cluster of secret society. And this was selected good old Henry L. Stinson. Now, I just wanted to focus on this guy for a second, because this was Roosevelt's Secretary of War. Now, Stinson is the one that General Patton in 1945 wrote to. He said he had a problem. Patton said, he said, there really is a problem and a question of the pro-Jewish influence in the military government of Germany. Right. That's a quote out of Patton's diary, but he wrote to Stinson. Now, here's a problem. Stinson is a Skull and Bones member.
Yeah.
Shock. So you see the problem here is that it's just a clump of secret societies everywhere. Democracy doesn't have a chance, you see.
Patton being naive and profane.
And he went to Stinson without knowing. And I think he went to him because he thought that he wasn't Jewish, that maybe he would, you know, give him an honest ear to this problem. because Patton talked about that there was this real bias that he was troubled by, and he thought it was going to lead to a bad situation in Europe down the road. But he went to Stinson. See, this is who he thought he could get a fair hearing with, but he didn't understand that Skull and Bones were basically already complicit in the war, because they were the ones that Montague Norman used to create Brown Brothers Harriman to fund the German war machine so that nation could basically commit suicide with it.
So I gather it wasn't too long after this that Patton had his accident?
Yeah, it was like 2 weeks later. So you know, this was like what you call a career-limiting decision there on poor George's part, where he writes to Stinson about this. And incidentally, I was just going to mention, like people have asked, you know, because it's kind of like the Pearl Harbor thing, you know, like, well, what's the evidence for this, you know? But you have analytic evidence. You have logic and probability, and you can actually approach the truth about Patton, for example, just as an example, through some analytic techniques. I mean, there were perhaps, I don't know, 30, maybe more, but high-level military commanders during World War II, you know, there was in the British and United States military and Navy, right? There's maybe that many. Patton is the only one to have basically complained about this, right? He complained about this in letters to his wife. He complained about this. You could see it in his diary, and he certainly wrote the letter to Stinson, that he didn't understand why Jews were being given preference, and he was extremely upset about Eisenhower's treatment of German soldiers, and he made a statement that he said it was Semitic. That's what Patton wrote, and he could prove it. Now, this makes Patton very unique. He's the only one bringing up these issues, and of all of the high-level military commander, he's the only one to die under mysterious circumstances. So the odds are here, you see, this is an analytic technique. The odds are you're looking at a deliberate murder, right? The idea that circumstance is far-fetched, because nobody else had this particular way of death after all of these military high-level guys. Well, how come just Patton did? Well, it's more probable that it's because of his stance that he caught the attention of the secret society. They didn't like it, and they got rid of him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about these, the higher level, what's going on here? We have these wars. Looking at World War II and even the First World War, is you have to look at it in the context of, again, the overall objective. Obviously, we talked recently about Norman Dodd and what his investigation uncovered for the Rees Committee about what the foundations are doing on behalf of the secret societies to sort of drag the country, the United States, into the war to the purpose of fundamentally changing society and collectivizing it. And also, so you have that high-level conspiracy afoot. And they've had successfully ensconced their agents in various government posts in these things. I think it was James Perloff, he was talking about Pearl Harbor. And this may interest you because you're like into blood relations.
Yes, I am.
Is that if you look at in the Spanish-American War, it was Teddy Roosevelt, who was the Undersecretary of the Navy, when the Maine blew up in Havana Harbor, that led to America's declaration of war against the Empire of Spain in 1898. Of course, this leads the way for the United States expansion into Asia, which sets the stage for the eventual Pacific War. But when the Lusitania gets torpedoed in 1915, I think the Assistant Secretary of the Navy is Franklin Roosevelt. And at the time, the First Lord of the Admiralty is Winston Churchill, his cousin. And then, of course, shoot ahead to the Second World War and Pearl Harbor. And again, you have Franklin Delano Roosevelt, of course, is the President of the United States, and Winston Churchill is then the Prime Minister of Great Britain. So these figures are all around these, suspicious false flag staged events or provoked events. So that's an important connection there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like looking at Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I mean, do you know who Delano was? Delano?
Well, I know they made a lot of money in the opium trade, right?
Yeah. Delano, who Franklin is named after, he wasn't just a big shot. He ran the Russell and Company opium trade in Canton and Hong Kong.
And that's
he was number one. It was from 1833 on. Warren Delano was the number one. It was called, that was the number one was his title in the Russell and Company in China.
And the Russell Trust is what created Skull and Bones.
Exactly. Yeah. Do you see the small circle and how impossible this is? Because he's working for Russell as the number one opium trader, right? He is helping to fund the creation of the Skull and Bones from the Russell Trust. And then you have to remember that then Delano worked with Palmerston to blow up the Chinese that were trying to rebel against the addiction. Palmerston, right, is the one who then in 1842 sets World War II in motion, basically, when he says now is the time for the Jews to return to their homeland. Mm-hmm. Because from that moment forward, you could see World War I and World War II were going to come about because they were all part of this Masonic project to create the state of Israel and to reduce European population. I'm telling you, it's an absolute straight line.
Yeah, it was James Perloff made this point about the necessity for U.S. intervention in the Second World War. It's not for the normal the reasons that most people think. Defeating Hitler is by 1941, the summer of 41. This is when the Roosevelt administration's campaign drive to war really kicks in. That's Lend-Lease was passed that year, and these things is, of course, you have the fall of France, but also you have Hitler's drive deep into Russia. And throughout the summer of 1941, it looks like he may indeed succeed in Russia. And that might not have been the plan. Again, when we talk about Hitler and Germany being set up, we're not saying that they're necessarily witting agents. They're just set up. Like the Japanese largely were set up. Perhaps there are some witty agents within that. It's true. I think we can entertain.
Yeah.
But they're set up. And so Japan and Germany are both provoked to act recklessly, to take on the world, so to speak. But this creates the environment to bring about certain objectives that will bring about what they call the New World Order. One thing is the establishment of the Israeli state. And eventually, perhaps even David Ben-Gurion says that the vision is for Jerusalem to be the world capital. And this requires certain things. One thing it requires the Balfour Declaration, requires the creation of the Jewish state. This comes to fruition because of both of the world wars. You also have the creation of Bolshevism and international communism, which was an important dialectic that the First World War started, but really it was the Second World War, because without the Second World War, you couldn't have had the Cold War. The Second World War, the results of the Second World War, unconditional surrender, the destruction of German power, the bringing in of Soviet power into the heart of Europe. This sets the stage for the Cold War, which creates the stage for which we all live under for the next 50, 60, 45 years is the Cold War. This also creates the pretext for, the things like world government agencies. I would say things like the United Nations. Perhaps it hasn't gone completely to plan, but things like the World Bank and IMF and these international, the Bank of International Settlements is a great example of that. That is an important weapon or tool that the global elite have for manipulating the global economies, because it's through the Bank of International Settlements, which was initially set up to work out German reparation payments, but it still lives on. Interesting. It is a sovereign, it's its own sovereign state. In Switzerland, Basel, Switzerland, but that coordinates all the world's central banks. And one thing you look at all these wars is it's always one objective is always to kind of rope in all the central banks and make it all one closed system. so we yeah. you can get an idea of how you know of the bigger picture here.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's there are many goals that the New World Order has. I mean, the State of Israel is one, the reduction of the European population. Basically, just what's going on in the world. I mean, you can these things are not exactly conspiracy theories any longer. I mean, if you talked about them in 1850, you would be, you know, kind of hard pressed to say, well, it's, you know, this isn't a wild-eyed conspiracy theory. But now this is just the stuff that's coming about. FDR, you know, is in my opinion, you know, we can certainly think of him as a potential crypto. But it's interesting because, you know, with FDR, you have that same that really odd relationship of the ability of Masons and Jews to get along is just extraordinary. Because I don't know if you, I'm sure, in fact, I think you are fully aware that the New Deal was nicknamed in many at that point, we had a little more freedom of the press. It was called the Jew Deal.
Now, why would they say something like that?
Well, you know, it's because if you look at a list of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's advisors and the people in charge of all of this, there's like about 100 Jewish people. And so people wondered about this. I mean, basically, you start out with Bernard Baruch, who was mm-hmm. finance advisor. Felix Frankfurter, you know, made him Supreme Court justice. He's like a secret society, you know, B'nai B'rith guy. I mean, I could just go on, Louis Brandeis. But you know who's, and of course, you know, Morgenthau of the genocidal Morgan mm-hmm. plan. But
Gary
you know,
Dexter White,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. But you know what really kind of amazed me was, Rabbi Stephen Wise. It turned out he's a very, very close friend and advisor of FDR. And this was, of course, leading right up to the authoritarian personality that yeah. Wise fund, right? And the bringing of the Frankfurt School into the United States, into American intelligence structure, right? Where, you know, these guys are working with the OSS and the CIA and, you know. But anyway, it's just this amazing kind of, you know, DNA that they share somehow, where they just get along terrifically and the New World Order can move forward. But I just think it's incredibly suspicious. It seems to indicate to me that there is some weird relationship, something that's undisclosed about Roosevelt's relationship with Jews. And I'll tell you, you know, the other person who noticed this was Patton. Patton, if you look at his letters at the end of World War II, he was really upset about it, that the Jews were being given special treatment. He said that, you know, he says that, you know, he noted in his diary on August 29th, 45, he says, "Today we received a letter to give Jews special accommodations." And then he wrote, "If for Jews, why not Catholics, Mormons, etc.?" Question mark. Right. So
he's good. Obviously anti-Semite.
Yeah. Horrible anti-Semite. Anyway. So, you know, This relationship is really kind of the question, I think, that has to get answered. And the way I would like to try to answer it is through genetic testing. I know it's I'm a scratchy record in this regard, but when you look at Skull and Bones, the secret society, the whole Masonic background of Roosevelt, right, that sure looks like it's hiding something. And then when you look at this absolutely incredible relationship he has with Jewish Americans. I mean, it's just beyond belief. There's just so many people. I mean, basically what Roosevelt surrounded himself with were Jews and secret society members, Masons and Skull and Bones guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's all I can find. I've been through like as far as I could start reading off here. I'd read for like 20 minutes about every single guy that is either a secret society member or a Jewish guy. So what happened, Tim? What happened to the everyday Joe Sixpack American? I'm not seeing any of these guys anywhere in the Roosevelt administration. Well, what's the explanation for that?
They were members in the American First Committee. Kind of a good-natured Midwestern folk.
Yeah, just good. I mean, I anyway, so
And so they never had a chance, considering what was arrayed against them. Nor did they really understand what was going on.
no, they were like Pat.
Because they themselves ran, they didn't notice sort of the ethnic dimension to this, the
Well,
ethno-religious
I
dimension.
think that, they did, because it was, like I said, it just was so overwhelming that people complained, and the New Deal was called. There was actually a very common slur, the Jew deal, because of just the incredible number of Jewish people that were involved in the running of the thing and the structure of it. And it bothered, it seemed undemocratic to Christian Americans because they had so little representation. And I mean, if they had also subtracted the secret society members, the Masons, like, I mean, like Harry Truman is supposed to be a Christian, right? So is Stinson. But, well, wait a second. When you're a secret society member, how can you really be sure that this guy is a Christian? What kind of a Christian is a Mason like, Harry Truman?
Well, look at, I mean, bring it up today. I guess we probably should draw some sort of comparison. We talked about Pearl Harbor and these things, and obviously the betrayal at Pearl Harbor and at the meta level, what was really going on, this agenda or this attempt to create a global conflagration to bring about a new world order, is we can we can compare the 9/11 to Pearl Harbor. Of course, that was called the New Pearl Harbor,
Yeah.
and the they had, of course, there are various commissions that covered it up. But just recently, we've had the death of George H.W. Bush. And we're given all sort of panegyrics about what a great American he was. He's given what appears to be a Christian burial.
Yeah, sort of.
And so the beat goes on, right? It never changes, right?
It
These
never changed, but I
yeah.
mean, but he's a Skull and Bones member. What kind of a
Yeah.
Christian is taking these oaths? Well, I mean, I just think that you just cannot accept at face value someone as a Christian who is a member in these secret societies where oaths are taken. You don't know what the oaths are. If you knew what the oaths were, what goes on in these secret societies, you'd have an idea about the person's background. But since you don't, you just cannot
Well,
accept them.
they shouldn't be given positions of public trust because it violates their oath of office.
Exactly. And then when you see, I mean, just in fact, I think with George Sr., it's just absurd. He gives a New World Order speech on September 11th,
1991,
11 years to the day before the event, right? Too many 11s, in my opinion. And this shows foreknowledge. So here again, now there you have. See, to me, this is like helping us understand Pearl Harbor, because there you had the new Pearl Harbor. The date of it, the whole structure of it was obviously understood, or it was going to happen 11 years before it occurred. 11 years before it occurred, they already had in mind that on that date they were gonna knock down the towers, right? No chance that Bush's speech is circumstantial. It's absolutely impossible. So that they are looking far ahead, and they have these dates and whatnot structured. So with Pearl Harbor, the original one, it should have been the same thing. I mean, it's logical that it was. And I would, if when I was asked, I was on this other show, and the guy said, "Well, how do you know that Pearl Harbor was actually this kind of, organized thing?" And I said, "It's all you have to do is look at Archduke Ferdinand's license plate. That's all you have to do." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, you should be aware of that. That's like should be like citizenship 101, because you look at the license plate and you see that it's the armistice. The date that the war is going to end is already recorded on the license plate of the event that brings the notice that this will then, like Pearl Harbor, right?" So think about this, Tim. You've got the George Sr.'s foreknowledge of 9/11, right, and the false flag that occurs there. You have Archduke Ferdinand's license plate clearly showing that they were had complete foreknowledge and control over both sides of the disaster of World War I. And then you have all of these Masonic influences inside of the Pearl Harbor. Well, it just seems that as far as I know, we don't have evidence of physical kind, but it is just analytically certain that it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. Just too many crazy Masons involved in this thing. You know that on the European side, they've got the whole deal wired all the way from Blavatsky right through to Adolf Hitler, you know? And so what do you think's going on here with the Japanese? It's all being manipulated. They want the world wars to occur. They will reduce populations that they want reduced, and they will set up political power for themselves, and they'll develop some great weapons too, right? This gave the excuse for the nuclear bombs, so, you know, which they blew up at Trinity, showing the, the idea of where they were, who the bomb was really intended for. So, you know, it's, I don't think that this picture is particularly hard to make sense of. There are a few details and pieces of evidence we don't have, but, you know, all the way from Archduke Ferdinand's license plate to 911 to the new Pearl Harbor, everything is orchestrated.
Yeah, it's a way to rig the system as well, because you, again, with the wars and the military spending, it's a huge transfer of wealth. The wars themselves run up the debt, and the debt is owed to somebody, right? To a few wealthy families who control the central banks, who issue the debt on money created out of thin air, and they collect interest, compound interest, which you can gradually, through compound interest, gradually gain control of all the world's resources.
Yeah, well, which is exactly what's happened.
Yeah.
You know, and so now the corporations, you get these corporations like, well, at this point, I mean, the economy is literally a hologram. You have, Facebook and Amazon worth $1 trillion that don't even generate any income. But these are new world order structures. They're not real corporations. So, you know, this is our real history, gives us a real understanding of our present moment, and hopefully will enable people to rebel effectively, you know?
Yeah. And also, of course, I've mentioned this before, but the big myth about Pearl Harbor is that it was enabled, or at least allowed to... The raid was able to occur because of the failure to connect the dots. The various disparate agencies connect one another, bureaucratic sort of turf battles, failure to communicate, lack of coordination, and this is what led to the attack. Of course, we now know that the Washington was daily following the diplomatic cables from Japan. This was the magic code, I believe, purple code. So purple. They knew when relations were going to be cut off. Robert Stinnett points out that the Japanese Navy did not maintain complete radio silence, and so that was being tracked. There is a Dutch. Intelligence officer who was in the Office of Naval Intelligence, he claims that they were monitoring. They knew that Yamamoto's fleet was 200 miles away off the Hawaiian Islands. They knew it was going to happen. We now know that Admiral Kimmel was prevented from, he was also deprived of the resources, also prevented from flying reconnaissance flights, so they couldn't be detected. So they were kept from, General Short and Kimmel were deprived of the intelligence that Washington had at the time to enable the attack. But the whole idea is that the failure of the various military intelligence branches to coordinate would lead to the justification of the creation of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1947 under the National Security Act. Yeah. That's all a lie, because it wasn't. Yeah. They knew there was being coordinated. There was not a failure to connect the dots. The same excuse we heard on 9/11 to further increase the size of the intelligence community, create new agencies, these things, office, you know, Homeland Security, and you have the Director of National Intelligence now, as opposed to the central, intelligence agencies and these things. And so it's creation of this intelligence agency. It also led to the creation of the OSS, so sort of this dirty tricks, cloak and dagger operation, which was then folded into the CIA after the Second World War. So now we have this sort of a cryptocracy that can carry out black ops, which is who knows how big it is, because we don't know how big the black budget is. So that's the justification. The justification for secrecy, because we needed increased secrecy in intelligence agencies. Well, the fact of the matter is that they had all the information they needed in 1941. They just didn't connect. They purposely didn't connect the dots because they wanted it to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Well, really well said. I mean, that's a great description. Also, I like the idea that, the parallels between, all of the, terrorism in WW2 leading to the intelligence services, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just, it's just amazing, isn't it? That the CIA would come out of World War II. What an extraordinary thing, that Bateson would go to Truman and he would say, with the nuclear bomb, we really can't trust world wars as a, kind of a way to do political change. Now we need to be able to, have an agency that can get in there and start diddling with people's minds. And so the CIA was created. But then we have the new Pearl Harbor. And then what do you know? Here comes the NSA. Here comes, all of the alphabet soup intelligence companies now. And they're, using all of their fancy technology to snoop on us. It's just a ratcheting up of the New World Order slave system. And it's they're using the same structure that they used back in World War II. And probably back as far as World War, certainly as far as World War I. So yeah. We're just seeing that over and over again, the same thing being played out. The citizens should be waking up to this, right? They should be able to see it, that it's just the same thing over and over again.
Well, I mean, obviously, people have been given this example. It's the, in 2000, you had the Project for a New American Century. Remember, the American Century was enabled by Pearl Harbor. This was Henry Luce's American Century, Skull and Bones, the idea of this Anglo-American empire. Now, this is the new American Century, extending into the 21st century. Really, it's Anglo-American, Geo-Masonic. You shouldn't think of these things in nation-states, terms of nations and these things. But the PNAC, the Project for New American Century, they're rebuilding America's defenses in 2000, called, for this expansion of military, of muscular military intervention in the post-Cold War era. Supposedly we had vanquished our enemies in the Cold War, but still, the world needed to be controlled by this unipolar empire. And, of course, they anticipated resistance to this. And so just the same way that the Roosevelt administration could not get America overtly into the war against Hitler in 1941, they needed a Pearl Harbor. The PNAC called for a new Pearl Harbor, a catastrophic and catalyzing event. And lo and behold, a year later, they got it. And many of the people who signed this were the people who would populate the Bush administration and implement these programs. And also, in the course, get very wealthy in terms of, in the process. That's always a part of it, too. Everyone gets their beak wet, very wet.
Yeah, and the secret society has fun, laughing at us. They had a movie with Ben Affleck.
Oh, gee, yeah, Pearl Harbor.
Pearl Harbor.
Yeah,
I think it was called Pearl Harbor. And there was these kind of bizarre, symbolic foreknowledge sort of thing. Both Ben Affleck and the and Josh Harnett, his sidekick. Had square and compass rings.
Oh, really?
Just very briefly seen. You actually have to look them up very carefully, but they hide this stuff in there, so that it's just a way of branding.
Well, isn't it funny that the movie about Pearl Harbor would come out in the summer of 2001 in the run-up to the new Pearl Harbor that was called for by the PNAC document the year before?
It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. Hollywood must have be run by people with crystal balls that can actually see the future, And then to throw in the little, the little vignette where Affleck, shows off just for a few seconds the, his square and compass ring, And then a few minutes later, you could, if you're very carefully paying attention, you can see Josh Harnett has one on too. Hey, folks, I mean, they're just laughing at us, you know? They're just laughing at us because we don't see that all of this is just, you know, it's, you have a dramatic theater where real people are dying, you know?
Yeah.
The events are not as we're being told. This is not history unfolding. Everything is being orchestrated to create the rationale that people will accept genocide from.
And John Voight plays Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And he's, I remember there's a scene in it where he's in his cabinet and they're talking about how they just aren't prepared for war. And I don't know how they're going to coordinate this and do this. We're asking the impossible. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, played by John Voight, gets up out of his wheelchair. Of course, he's crippled, and he stands for a few seconds, proving that he can do the impossible if you have the will.
Wow. I mean, it's so heroic.
And Ben Affleck, I think his character is like an American who goes off to fight in the Battle of Britain, comes back, and now he's over there in Hawaii. So he's just going around, you know, from theater to theater, you know, saying, you know, he's the American involving himself in these foreign conflicts. And that's the example that we all should follow.
Well,
I guess.
Tim, I'm afraid it's just one big lump of crypto Freemason cesspool.
Yeah,
all the way from Palmerston to, you know, the new Pearl Harbor. That you can, if, once you start picking this thing apart, you can really see it. You know, it's just so sad to look at the deliberate genocide of the European people and the Japanese people too. They've been targeted for some reason as well, you know, and they are just, I mean, at this point, the birth rates are collapsing. Yeah. The you know, there's just wave after wave of assault upon these populations. And they don't understand that this is deliberate. You see, this is the thing, Tim, is that, you know, I hope that with this show and all the others we've done, that we've actually fleshed out the schematic of what's going on. I you know, hopefully as we go forward with the show and do, you know, hundreds and hundreds of them, God willing, you know, we can just get right down into the details. You know, sometimes, you know, there's going to be repetition because it's like, to, in my opinion, to really understand, you know, Pearl Harbor, you have to go forward from there to the new Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. because you get to see, you know, like these are parallels, they're happening over and over again. And you have to go backwards too. You have to look at, you know, Archduke Ferdinand's license plate.
Yeah. And they ask us to remember these days, like Pearl Harbor's. Is Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. Well, how can you remember the event when most people don't even understand what really happened?
Yeah, that's exactly right. But see, the thing is that, and I just hope that, you know, in our audience, that people don't, you know, they go, oh my God, we're on Blavatsky again.
Well,
or,
I mean, that's an important element. That's the meta level, and you have to look at these things that way because that's what the evidence suggests. But if you want, this isn't to say you can't get into the, like, so when I was earlier talking about this sort of the argument that for the necessity of U.S. entry, how it just isn't the case. You can study the military history, the geopolitical situation that was going on at the time. You can study the diplomatic history of these things. All these things are very important grammar to understand these events.
Absolutely. And then, and none of them make any sense. In other words,
that's not the thing. They don't make any sense. So you're like, what's going on here?
Yeah, it's like, so this is what, that kind of analysis, that just absolute, straightforward, clear-minded historical analysis, which shows that there's just no reason for this event to actually occur, that mm-hmm. that could have been avoided, and it wasn't. So now you have the question, well, why? Why wasn't it avoided? You know, and they say, well, Roosevelt wanted to fight Hitler. Right. Really, he wanted to fight Hitler. You know, I mean, so the thing is, you know, we just try to give the facts and analysis that can help people see that, you know, there is a war being waged that doesn't stop. You see, it's not like World War II ended or World War I ended. The war, these are just phases in the war, you know. it's like Kipling said, you know, he says, beneath the rabbi's curls and fur of sense and rings of movie kings, the aloof, unleavened blood of Ur brewed steadfast on Jerusalem, and burdened Gentiles over the main must bear the hate of Israel's, bear the weight of Israel's hate. Well, I mean, you know, that poem's nearly 100 years old, and
it rings true today, that's for sure.
And I don't know what to say, you know. Yeah. I mean, it seems pretty straightforward to me that you could apply this to. And, you know, it's like people, I get a lot of criticism, Tim. You hard to imagine, isn't it? You know, on this idea of crypto. You know, they say, well, you can't prove this, you know. And I'm saying, yeah, I can't. You're right. I mean, how do I prove it? It's analytically a serious question, though. And it's one I know that has to be answered because it's a question that's never permitted to be asked, you see.
Well, it's been an issue ever since the Converso crisis, at least. So
exactly.
And again, if you think that was just paranoia, anti-Semitism, you know nothing of what was going on in Spain in the 15th century.
So, well, exactly right. And the thing is, so now when you get to the New Deal and you read in the newspaper that the Gentiles are calling it the Jew deal and they don't understand why there's every single, you know, authority person inside the administration is Jewish, they're asking what's going on. This is a legitimate question.
And if you're not alert to it, that's when they really inveigle themselves and take over.
Yeah.
And that's been the problem today, because if you're somewhat alert to it, you have a self-defense mechanism, and it may inhibit their conspiring. But if everyone is inhibited or afraid to ask the question or be skeptical about it, that's when they can run one wild, yeah, and exactly. Apparently they have, yeah.
And then, of course, because out of the first Pearl Harbor, we get the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And so now you have the most powerful force of intimidation imaginable. Now it's like, you know, it's sort of like the pawnbroker and the naked woman's breast. It's like, who's going to say boo? It's the Holocaust, right?
Yeah, I was reading just a critique of some Pearl Harbor conspiracy theorists, as we're called, about. And I was reading the article, and it was critical of it. He said, "This he has given speeches at many Holocaust denial organizations. So therefore, because he's skeptical, the organization may be skeptical of the Holocaust narrative, what this one researcher is saying about Pearl Harbor, and then it should be held and should not be taken seriously. See the trick there, you know?
Right. Yeah. Of course. You know? And so they you know, and then it's, well, it's just like coming up with the expression conspiracy theory. No, it's something
which was a CIA conspiracy,
right? In fact, so they just you know, they have studied us. They have techniques to control our thinking, and the way to, you know, our responsibility and everyone's responsibility is just to not be intimidated, bring up the correct questions. And do enough research so that you know what the important questions are and have some capacity in terms of answering them.
Okay. I think we covered it?
Yes, sir. I do indeed, Tim. Well, I mean, day of infamy, it certainly was.
Okay, Joe, I'll let you go. And
all right,
next week.
Thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
Take it easy. Bye.
Bye-bye.